from Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour as we move ever closer to Holy Week, to Easter Sunday, to the resurrection of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. It's a hugely important time of year for those of us who are Catholic, for those of us who are Christians, and this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it, and we are rejoicing and glad to welcome in Troy Illerman to our radio. Unfortunately, not in person, but virtual. Troy, good day to you.
Good day to you as well.
Good to hear your voice, Troy. Thanks so much for joining us. Troy is a mentor with the Exodus Project here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Troy, tell us about the Exodus Project and how you learned about it.
Well, I learned about it. Rita Spillane is a former prosecutor,
right,
and she and I had worked together in my former life, and she gave my name to Seth Castleman,
mm-hmm,
who the executive director of Exodus Project.
Right, Rabbi Seth Castleman, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So I became involved by that, you know, you do an interview, fill out an application, and then they decide, you know, if you're a good fit. And it's a sorely needed project because, you know, we incarcerate more people in the United States probably than anywhere else. And there's really, I'm a former inmate. When you get out, you have really no idea how to acclimate and reenter society. And Exodus Project is trying to fill that gap of you're directing people towards housing, substance abuse recovery. You know, you're sitting and talking with your mentee, encouraging, which is it's a void that hasn't been filled. We treated our, people that have been incarcerated, we treat them as lesser citizens, and, you know, to the least of our brethren is kind of our motto, and I'm excited to be part of it. Seth is a great leader, and I think, you know, we're doing some good work.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I grew up in a really small community. I don't know if you know, if you're native Californian, but if you are, you probably know. A place called Stony Ford.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you go up to Maxwell and you head west.
Yeah, exactly. So you're familiar with it. So 12 people, my graduating class. My grandfather was raised on the Native American Indian Reservation. Yeah, he was half Indian, and he had a ranch. So we were grew up in a very rural, agriculture lifestyle.
Right.
And my family and I had four sisters. We traveled probably from the time I was 6 years old. We traveled throughout the United States and Canada just performing stunts. Trick riding is what they call it.
Oh, wow.
In rodeos. And I was a professional bull rider as well. So did that in college, did it after college. I then went to law school at UC Davis and practiced law until 2004, I believe. And then I went back and became the commissioner of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association.
Oh, wow.
Then it all broke. it all came undone in 2005 or 6, I guess. I went to prison in 2007 for leaking transcripts in the Balco's. I represented somebody in the Balco steroid case, and there was an order that not to leak grand jury transcripts, and I leaked them, and I lied to the judge about it, and so I was sentenced to 33 months in prison in the federal penitentiary, and got out, and ever since been trying to rebuild my life and learn the lessons that I needed to learn.
So that's a felony conviction?
Yeah. Yeah. It's I pled guilty to 4 felonies, obstruction, contempt, and perjury.
Mm-hmm. And presumably that would result in disbarment as well.
I resign with charges pending, but it's effectively the same thing.
Right,
yes.
Right. Yeah. Is there a possibility to, you know, resuscitate a legal career?
There is. I went before a judge, one time already, and they said no. I mean, there's a measuring period of time where you have to, and I get it, that, you know, if you're they want to know that they can trust you. So there's got to be a period of time that you have shown, you know, redemption, remorse, rehabilitation. And they have a time frame for that. I'm actually going to go try again coming up. So we'll see if it happens. You know, I'm at a place in my life where I trust God. So if it happens, you know, I think I've done the work. But if it happens, great. If not, God has something else.
Well, God allowed you to have that experience, certainly in prison, and it looks like what you're doing now is to try to help somebody who had a similar experience.
Yeah, there's the, I've represented in my former life hardcore criminals and then mentoring them. I found that, you know, it's better to not lead with that because they're skeptical anyway. But they do, once you get to know them and you disclose that, then, you know, you can have a conversation on a different level. You're just not, you've been behind the glass, so you know what it's like. But, you know, there's a lot of pain involved and shame and guilt and
sure.
A lot of stuff, that comes from being in prison. And when you get out, you still have that. And it takes a while to work through it. And, you know, if we can just walk alongside our fellow brothers and sisters and just be with them in their pain and talk with them and encourage them and provide them resources, I think that's what we're called to do because, there's an expiration date on our life.
I'm looking for where I was stamped. I haven't found it yet, but I'm looking.
Well, you know, my mom just recently died. She died. She was 87. She got COVID and had a stroke. But there's a beauty. Not, you know, we were sad, but there's a beauty knowing that she's going to heaven. But
yep.
There's a beauty knowing that she lived her life with integrity and very much, you know, at the foot of the cross. And I haven't done that, and I'm trying to do that, but there's you think probably about this more when you get older, about, you know, your term date, and I think you make adjustments and say, I want to do something deeper, more relational, and stuff that counts for something. And I think the hardest part about people who've been in prison or who have failed is to integrate your failure and make it a part of who you are. You're mm-hmm. You have failed, but you're not a failure, and that's kind of the message we try to give.
You know, I've heard more than once in the last year or so an expression which I hadn't heard before, and it had to do with the form of forgiveness people saying. When they're why they're giving someone a second chance or a third chance, they say we're all better than our worst day.
Yeah,
you know, and it's that really has struck home with me that because I can be very judgmental and go this guy did that or she did this, you know, I don't trust him, whatever, and you go wow, I wouldn't want to be judged on my worst day.
Yeah, no, I mean, but for the grace of God go I.
Right.
And I had never planned, if you would have asked me at 19, I mean, I was a little reckless, if I was going to go to prison. No, I was always goal-oriented. I was trying to, you know, walk the ladder of success. And I never paid attention to things that are important, and that's your family system, stuff that's going on inside of you that I should have dealt with, but I just didn't deal with it. And it caught up to me, and the consequences are, harsh, but there's a flip side to that. I believe now that I'm authentic, and I can, when you're able to say, yes, I was wrong,
mm-hmm.
without trying to cover it up in whatever you do, there's just a beauty in living in honesty, integrity, and a willingness to mature and evolve. And I learned that lesson the hard way, and most people don't have to go through that. But I think it also brought me to a place of, who is Christ? Who is God? What does he mean in my life? Do I reject him? Do I accept him? Because you're looking down the road going, I'm going to be out of here, at 70, 80 years old. What is, it seems like a complete joke if all we lived is kind of existential hedonistic lifestyle for 80 years and then we're gone.
Yep.
And you think about those things, you go, there's more to life than just this. So that interruption, that prison experience, did me more good than harm in terms of redirecting me.
And it didn't change God's love for you, your crime.
No, and that's what I think the hardest part, Bob, is that you have to learn how to love yourself, mm-hmm. not in a egotistical way, but in a way that you care for yourself the way God expects us to care for ourselves.
So did you learn things in prison that help you now as a mentor in the Exodus Project?
Yeah, there was there's what they call, in a federal prison, they have what they call a 500-hour substance abuse program, mm-hmm. that is DBT, it's cognitive behavioral therapy, that was really good. You learn how to migrate conflict better. In prison experience, you've got to learn how to get along, more so than on the outside. And then I actually went and got a master's in marriage and family therapy when I got out,
mm-hmm.
which incorporates a lot of the stuff that, we use now in mentoring people.
Was it hard to get into a school with a felony conviction?
Yeah. I mean, there's, when you have felonies, you're always having to go through the background, stuff. You're disclosing it. Yeah, it's difficult, but not impossible.
And do you do that now as a marriage family counselor?
No, the licensing thing is you can graduate, but then you have to go through the licensing process, which I got approved. It's funny, I'm 58 years old. I have a 27-year-old son, a 23-year-old daughter, and then I have two twin boys that are 3 years old. So to get your license, you actually have to, other than your, if I was just doing it full-time, it'd be fine, but I do paralegal work, so you're going to have to dedicate 40 to 50 hours a week of therapy, just volunteer, to get your license. And I don't have the time to do that, maybe someday, but it's an undertaking that, I contemplated, but I think right now with my obligations, I just don't have the time to do it.
We have a few similarities, though, in that we both had kids at what society would consider a later age.
Yeah, I'm going to be 74 when they graduate from high school, so that'll be fun.
I can relate to you almost exactly.
Well, good.
we maybe we'll have to have a joint graduation party for our kids.
Yeah, we definitely should.
Yeah, indeed. Let's see, I'm doing the math. When my youngest son graduates from high school, I'll be 76. So,
we're almost the same then.
Yeah. And of course, his friends say, is your granddad coming? Because he doesn't know any different. He thinks that's how old dads are supposed to be.
Yeah, they don't.
Yeah, well, good for you. That's great. So when you talk about the Exodus Project, in terms of the commitment to it from your standpoint? What does Exodus Project ask of you?
You can do as I say. I mean, it's kind of a hands off. I mean, you're on your own, so you could do nothing if you chose, but nobody has taken that approach. And I think eventually that they would just say, look, it's not working out. But they ask you to commit to so many hours a week. Now, they're not monitoring you, but they ask you to check in with your mentee. They ask you to meet with them. But the beauty of this is they're not sending you out, unarmed, because there's a three-day training. I mean, if you've seen the material, you'd be very impressed. It wasn't thrown together as an idea and then just stayed an idea. It was thought out over a 3 or 4 year period.
Mm-hmm.
And then they actually have 3-day training sessions for the mentees or the mentors.
Mm-hmm.
And bring in people from RCCC, which are, law enforcement, and they give you their side. They have therapists. They have a number of people that come in that are experts. And then they have formal training. And then we actually meet once a month via Zoom. Now, we used to meet in person. And we all check in. How's it going? What works? What doesn't? And then they have an office set up with 2 people. I think there's 3. But they are actually experts, and you can call them up and say, look, I'm having a problem getting my mentee into housing. And then Chris, who's, I don't know if you've met Chris Martin, but he actually is, I mean, he's very knowledgeable, and he'll take your information. And then, so it's a very communal effort. Everybody is interested in seeing your mentee succeed. So if people have information, they share it. It's everybody that I've run into in the Exodus Project, they're loving, they're caring, they're in it for the right reason.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be. I mean, and I think most people that are drawn to this type of work, are drawn for the right reasons. They really want to see people that are, have a setback. They want to see them succeed.
How does the mentee find you? Is this obviously voluntary on their part?
Yeah. It's kind of like the dating game. You actually go interview. The last 2 I would actually would go talk with, whether RCCC, where they're incarcerated, or sometimes they're already out. So what Seth does is Seth goes and interviews people that have applied. He then assigns a person, says, hey, I think this person would be good for Troy, or this person would be good for Chris. And then you actually go talk with the person, and then that person can say, yeah, I don't think it's a good fit, or I do think it's a good fit. So it's a very relational type approach, and if the person doesn't feel like it's going to work, then he has a choice to say no.
So are they more likely to say no to you or no to the program?
Well, they've already, I would say that it wouldn't be that they would say no to the program, because they have already, they sent in a application to staff.
Mm-hmm.
And staff looks through the applications, and I don't know, what goes into that, but he looks at them and then he'll say, okay, these people, meet the criteria. And then, so once they've been vetted and Seth has interviewed them, the only remaining kind of question is this going to work? Does the mentee believe that you are going to work with him in a way that's going to benefit him, or are they, mm-hmm. Do they, it's relational, or whatever the mentee says. I mean, he can thumbs up or thumbs down, and then, so that's really the only question left.
And a male mentor will always be with the male mentee, and same for female. Yeah. So at this, obviously there are many guidelines about who the mentee can be, I'm sure. Are they at, they're obviously at a later state of their incarceration? about to get out?
Yeah, there's some that they have. It's very, you know, RCCC is they have you know, the Exodus Project is well known there, so they make it known to the inmates that this is available, and then the inmates choose whether or not they want to be, you know, want to apply.
RCCC is Real Cosumnes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it's you know, it's a program that's available to them. RCCC says, hey, look, if this is available, and then they choose whether or not they want to be part of it. And I don't know how far into their sentence they can apply. I'm assuming, I mean, there's some people that we're mentoring that were down for a long time, but I don't know if you know about realignment. Realignment in California is, I think, if I remember correctly, they used to say if anybody got sentenced over a year, you'd go to state prison, you'd go to Tracy and be processed, and
right.
then you would go to whatever prison. Well, now, with realignment, I think it's 5 years or under, you can actually go serve your time in county at the county.
Yeah, I think 5 years is the right figure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's how, you know, so there's might be some that have been, you know, brought down to RCCC, but most of them, people in our program, they don't have a lot of time left, maybe 6 months or 7 months. I don't know the exact time, Seth would know, but there's not a lot of time, you know, they have left to serve by the time, you know, they decide to enter into a relationship with us.
Mm-hmm. So if you can give us a stereotype, obviously you don't violate any you know, confidentialities, but can you give us a stereotype of the first meeting between the mentor and the mentee?
Well, I think it's always a from the mentees. I mean, just from my experience, the mentee would be looking at us with skepticism and mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just way. I mean, when the prison environment kind of fosters that, you don't know who you can trust, not trust. And you're just trying to get through the time the best way you know, and the relationships aren't deep. You know, they're probably, you know, just so you can make it through. And so when you meet, the initial meeting, really, there's not a lot of conversation about, hey, let's do this, let's do that. Because this is my experience, they want to know if you're going to follow through on just being a mentor. Meaning, are you going to call me? If I need something, can I get a hold of you? If you say you're going to meet me at Starbucks and we can just have a conversation, are you actually going to be there?
Mm-hmm.
So the initial meeting, what I normally do is just ask them to tell me about themselves and what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get too much into, you know, what they did in the past, because they can volunteer that. But it's more just getting to know each other and getting a feel. They're looking at you like, you know, because I don't know, you probably know this, but most of the people that I've mentored, the family structure that they came from really isn't intact or has been shattered.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of broken relationships. And so they're viewing you through the lens of their past.
Sure.
And they're just going, are you just going to do a drive-by? And are you in this so you can just check a box and
sure.
look pretty for the crowd? And so we visit. We visit. I buy them coffee. And those conversations, from my experience, it takes two or three conversations. You know, I got one guy a five. We just talked about five. And he really didn't open up until probably about 4 months into the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
So then where does it go from there?
Well, then you're looking at practical things. It's more utilitarian at that point, because you're looking at, hey, look, at I need to get a job. How do I get a job? Where do I get a job? You know, with a felony record, who's hiring? I need housing. Where do I get housing? What's available? So your contact, it's more of a practical approach at that point because they have practical needs. Some of them don't have housing. They need to figure out, you know, how can I get a phone? How can I get, you know, any kind of assistance? And just find, you know, we're set up, Exit is set up, they have the relationship with housing, they have different, you know, bus passes, different things, just practical stuff. That's all a network that Exodus has already set up. So we can just go to, or, you know, Seth or Chris and say, look, I need this. They try to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And then we provide that to the mentee. And that's really, you know, a bulk of what we're doing and trying to assist him. I mean, I got my my current mentee, I went and got him business cards so he can hand them out on the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to get them to write, draft a resume for him, draft letters for him, just try to help them, you know, do things that they need help with on a practical level.
How much can you help them with employment?
Well, you know, everybody says, you know, we don't have to check the box because, you know, we're not going to run a background check. They all run a background check.
Sure.
I'm quite upfront about that with my mentees that they're going to. But if it's not involving money or something like that, I deal with a lot of the people that are in the construction trade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an easier approach because, you know, a vocation, most of the people are going to hire you if you have a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to get caught up into, okay, you had a felony. I mean, that's just my experience in terms of getting my guys a job. If you're going to try to get a license or something, it's going to be a lot more difficult.
Right, right.
That's my experience, and that's been experience with one other mentee that I actually wasn't my mentee, but somebody else, and we were just trying to assist that person. And it just, you know, it's a long road.
Are most of the people, before they got in trouble, were they employed? Were they working? Did they have a type of job that they could go back to?
Some of them have been chronically unemployed, and it was just, you know, it's a mix.
Yeah.
The mentees that I have worked with, for the most part, were employed in some kind of vocation. And the person I'm mentoring now was long-term employed in the construction trade. And, you know, there's drug use in every walk of life, but, you know, pretty heavy in the construction world. So that's a byproduct, I guess, of what they're involved in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about substance abuse? Is that a concern?
We actually have resources. There's many resources, you know, in Sacramento, but a lot of the people that we're mentoring are on some type of requirement to either do, you know, AA or some kind of, you know, NA, something that's going, you know, because that's just a condition of their probation.
Sure.
Or parole. So they're required to do that, and they're tested. So that's something that we can help with, but they're already required to do that. At least the ones I'm mentoring are required to do that as a condition of their probation or parole.
Do those restrictions, whether they're probation or parole, Do those sort of things, do they really make a person walk the straight and narrow or not?
Do the conditions?
Yeah, in other words, you can't do this, or you have to go to AA, or you can no longer If we test you for drugs, you're going back in prison. Do those things really keep them off?
No. And I'm going to, I would say no, because the person has to be at a place in their life where they are actually wanting to do the work. Because if you tell somebody they have to do something, it may work for a little while, but you're not, that person has to make the choice to say, this is a commitment I'm making to change my lifestyle.
Right.
And that isn't, you can't make somebody do that if you say you have to do this. They either decide they're going to do it or not.
Right. Right. So would you recommend the Exodus Project to people that are listening now?
Absolutely. I think it's something that has been needed for a while, that they finally have put together. And in Sacramento, I don't know of any other program that's like this. There could be, but I'm not aware of it. And, you know, with Seth Castleman running it, I would recommend this highly to anybody. I think it's going to just continue to grow and be a good option, even for the judges to say, this is something you should do after after you've served your time and you're out on probation or parole. This is something I think could assist you. Because look, we all look at, hey, the person's sentenced, he goes to jail, and everybody goes, okay, fine, society's great now. That's not when you should worry. It's when the person tries to integrate back into society and there's a void. There's nobody helping them. They're either going to commit a crime or they're going to go back. Whatever the result is, this lessens that likelihood. And I believe we're called as people who believe in Christ to help those who are lesser and have had stuff in their life happen to them, maybe through their own choice, but we're still called to assist them.
Whatsoever you do for the least of my brothers.
Yeah.
Those are Jesus' words. If Jesus spoke them, they mean something.
Well, I know that people, in my state, when I was trying to figure it out, I had a lot of people step in and, give me a hug. I mean, here's what you need when you get out. You need a hug. You don't need a lot of instruction. That instruction will come, and I have a lot of people hugging on me, and that meant a lot, and I want to pass that on.
That's great. Well, speaking of calling, I think I hear one of those twins calling you, Dad.
He was. Could you hear him?
I've got that dad's ear. I could.
Yeah, you heard him.
Joy, it is just a pleasure to meet you, even virtually, and I hope the day comes soon when our paths cross in person.
Hey, well, thank you so much. You have a great day.
You too. God bless. Thanks so much. That's Troy Ellerman, a mentor in the Exodus Project, and they're always looking for volunteers. You will be assigned to someone who's either incarcerated and about to get out, someone maybe who just got out, and help them with a great variety of things. And generally, maybe 5 to 8 hours a month is what they talk about, and you'll undergo good training so you learn exactly what's expected and what's allowed, what's not allowed, what the boundaries are, et cetera, and what the goals are. It's a really tremendous program here in the Diocese of Sacramento, and the directing it is Rabbi Seth Castleman, a great person for that role. Absolutely. We'll take a quick break. Back with more right after this.
This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is
one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
This is Bishop William K. Wiegand, the Bishop Emeritus of Sacramento, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Denning.
Thank you, Bishop Wiegand, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you for all you have done, continue to do for all of us here in the Diocese of Sacramento, and prior to that, the Diocese of Salt Lake City, and the Diocese in Columbia, and the Diocese of Boise in Idaho. So remarkable journey, and we all greatly appreciate and love everything you have done for us. We have wonderful workshops going on despite this pandemic here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Parent support, playing the sports as a Catholic, it's more than pointing upward when you score a goal. And the director of the CYO, the Catholic Youth Organization in the Diocese of Oakland, Phil Ford, joins us now. Phil, good day to you. Thanks so much for joining us on the Bishop's Hour.
Hi, you're welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Catholic Youth Organization. I remember it well from my youth in Northern California in the Sacramento Valley, but I haven't heard of it much recently. Is it more of a big city thing now?
Well, it depends on the city. It's recently we knew that we probably had close to 500,000 kids playing country nationwide.
Wow.
And so, but it, you know, big cities are obviously a little bit more active and compact than smaller areas.
Mm-hmm.
So Oakland, at this point, our diocese is two counties, Alameda and Contra Costa.
Right.
And we have about 15,000 kids engaged in CYO.
Oh, my goodness. What age group?
Kindergarten, for very limited, up through the eighth grade.
Uh-huh.
And we play a variety of sports, boys and girls basketball, track and field, cross country, volleyball, boys sand volleyball, which is always a highlight.
Sand volleyball?
Boys sand volleyball.
Yeah, sand volleyball, is since the Olympics, I guess, has really taken off. A lot of the colleges are playing it now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Is it two on two?
No, it's we play four on four.
Four on four.
Two on two would be a bit much for that age group.
For that age group, sure. Yeah, I look at Sam. I think volleyball is hard. And my teenage son is on the volleyball team at his high school, and not sand volleyball. I think it's hard enough on a hard surface. I can't imagine playing it in sand.
What's nice is that they're in a public park in Fremont,
uh-huh,
our diocese, and families come and they picnic and the kids go on the court. It's pretty low key and it's just a lot of fun.
Oh, so, boy, I'll bet. I'll bet. Yeah, volleyball's a great game for that. So in terms of teams playing teams, are they organized by school or not?
You mean in CYO generally?
Yeah.
By parish.
Uh-huh.
And so parishes enter teams. So the program is fed through the local parish. So
right.
Part of the, you know, when the workshop is that how is this a Catholic environment? And, you know, one thing I think CYO does is you represent your parish, whether it's your Catholic school, whether you're in religious education, even if you're a neighborhood kid and you're not Catholic, you represent the parish. So it draws, I think, in some sense, it forms identity with the parish church. And
mm-hmm,
then, of course,
sure,
it's an instrument for evangelization in that light.
And most of the coaches would be drawn from parents in that parish?
Right. So we have no professional coaches. They're all volunteers. Even the parish athletic directors are very dedicated people, and they're all volunteers. So it's really any funds that are raised or sign-up fees go directly to the benefit of children playing, not to salaries of the coaches or the athletic directors.
And CYO itself is under the auspices of the Diocese of Oakland?
Right. I'm the CYO director for the diocese, so my responsibility under the chancellor of the diocese is to organize and promote the CYO program in the diocese.
So what are your biggest challenges in doing that?
Well, first of all, it's, I think, sheer numbers. I mean, with the number of teams we have, and so there's just a lot of coordination involved.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't call it a challenge as much, but one of the things that we do, I think, well in Oakland are coaches certification workshops, where every coach every year attends a workshop, and we put on, as a diocese, we put on 22 workshops, anywhere from 50 people to 500 people at a workshop, with the goal of not only having them think about, you know, how to coach basketball, but the whole ministry and how to work with kids. And then, of course, you know, in light of what's happened in our church and our society, we very much have to screen, fingerprint,
sure,
train people through virtues training for safe environments. So,
and it is a ministry indeed, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of our games start with prayer, where both teams get together in center court or on the track and begin with prayer, reminding themselves that God's with them. All of our, many of our parishes start with an annual CYO Mass. And I think generally the pervasive attitude of the program has to be that we reflect Christian values. It's not about winning. It's about teamwork, forming relationships with coaches and with each other. So I think that's what makes it unique, because we are a church program and we have to have those values.
So in terms of you're coming up here to, well, you're not coming, it's a virtual workshop, March the 15th, 8 o'clock, here, is presented by you and the Diocese of Sacramento. What is the goal of a workshop like this?
Well, I think what we'll be doing is looking at youth sports in general, because, you know, youth sports is really pervasive in our society. And so we'll be looking at youth sports in general, because, you know, a vast majority of kids do play youth sports in some form, one way or the other. And then what are some of the challenges? As you said, what are the challenges of playing? What are some of the negatives? What are some of the positives? And then how can parents really work with their kids, I think, looking through the lens of our Christian values, and how to make sure that their sports experience is positive and reflects, you know, their values as Catholics. So it'll be a challenging hour, I'm sure. And I think parents are, my experience over years with CYO is parents are really invested in their kids, especially when it comes to sports, and how can we do that positively. So that'll kind of be the thrust of the workshop. The church itself has a very capable, very nice document that we'll talk about from the Vatican on sports and how the church can relate to sports and how we as church can be part of the sports environment positively and influence it. So,
yeah, it's interesting. You know, Pope John Paul II, Saint John Paul II, was an athlete, and certainly Pope Francis pays a lot of attention to sport, it seems.
Oh, sure. I have a great picture of Pope Francis being presented a basketball jersey by the Harlem Globetrotters.
Oh, wow. After he became Pope?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah.
And then all of the popes from, you know, the recent popes, John Paul and Pope Benedict and Pope Francis, all have, you know, really good quotes about, you know, their support of sports and what they feel the values of sports are. So they've been very active on that field. That was kind of a play on words on that field.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting, because sports have been a big part of my life, both as a competitor and also as a longtime sports writer and fan. And yet, you know, there are, it kind of goes through all forms of human behavior, from great sportsmanship and great moments and great everything to some really ugly moments, you know. And I know with my kids, and I know my dad with us, with my siblings and I growing up, it was like, if you're going to play sports, you remember sportsmanship first, you know, and respect for your opponent. And your opponent cares as much as you do. He's not a bad guy. He's not an enemy. He's just somebody you're playing a game with, you know, and keep that in perspective. But, boy, it's hard sometimes, because there is that scoreboard there, and we do tend to be competitive animals sometimes. And not that it would make you cheat, but it can make you, well, it can do that, but it can make you tunnel vision, I guess. You know, if a call doesn't go your way, or, you know, you've got a 3-2 count and the bases are loaded and you thought the ball was outside and that darn umpire called it a strike and your bat's still on your shoulder, you know, and it can. There are lessons to be learned there, but sometimes they're hard ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, when as the competition gets ratcheted up, and, you know, I think sometimes kids and parents see some bad actors, if you will, on the professional level.
On the TV, that's for sure.
Kind of bleeds down into us. And I mean, none of our players, hopefully, are making a living playing sports. It's an entirely different thing. And sometimes I think we confuse the two models. In Oakland, we have three, we call them points of emphasis, spirituality, sportsmanship, and service,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, we pray, our teams are asked to do service projects to the community and with each other, and then we emphasize, as you say, the whole sportsmanship. And, you know, we're certainly not perfect, and nothing is. I mean, certainly we occasionally have an incident that isn't necessarily reflecting our values, but I guess in the church for a long time ago, we used to call those teachable moments.
Right.
You know, what can we do about it, and how do we, and what do we learn from it? So,
yeah, it's you know, but you mentioned professional sports, and sometimes you see it in the college game too. It's. I've always understood people being sore losers, but now we have a lot of sore winners. You know, it's like, you know, they put the microphone in their face and it becomes nobody believed in me and I did this to, you know, or you intercept a pass and you go stick the ball in the quarterback's stomach, you know, and you go, now why was that necessary? You know, and you see, in my mind, you see way too much of it on TV and the kids are watching it. And I can remember when I was, you think that athletes aren't role models. I remember in my little league days, Roger Maris was chasing Babe Ruth. I'm dating myself. And he was on TV that day, that Saturday on, because there was one game with Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese. And Roger Maris had just a piece of tape around his wrist, just a simple piece of tape around his wrist. And that night at my Little League game, there must have been 90% of Little Leaguers had a piece of tape around their wrist. You know, it's just, you know, we're watching them.
We used to emulate Willie Mays in the basket catch. You know, drive the coaches crazy.
Yeah, that one was hard for me to emulate because I couldn't do it. But, boy, talk about iconic plays in the history of sport. That's got to be in the top 10.
Yeah. Well, for sure.
Yeah, I got to cover Willie Mays' final game as a sports writer. I think he was playing for the Mets.
I believe it was
in Oakland against the A's in a World Series. Willie had been, you know, so many of these stars, they don't end up where you remember them. You don't, you know, they end up, so like, I think Joe Montana ended up in Kansas City, you know, and you don't remember those things. But yeah, just a phenomenal, phenomenal athlete of all the athletes in the history of the world. He'd be in the top 10, I think. Just remarkable, remarkable. So, well, Phil, it is such a joy to talk with you. I'm looking forward to this workshop. Again, it's March 15th, 8 p.m. You can contact Jennifer Campbell here at 916-733-0135 or jcampbell@scd.org. Phil, thanks so much for all you do in the Diocese of Oakland, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon, I hope.
You're welcome. So thanks for having me on.
Great. God bless. Thanks so much. That's Phil Ford, the director of the CYO in the Diocese of Oakland. It should be a great, great workshop. For parents and your kids, parents support playing the sport as a Catholic. It's more than pointing upward when you score a goal. Now, there's a number of great workshops coming up here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Missionary Disciples, a 2021 retreat for parish vocations committees. Go and make disciples, for I'm with you always. This annual retreat provides a time for spiritual reflection, growth, ministry tools, and an opportunity for fellowship If you're not part of your parish vocation committee and would like to support the ministry of vocations, you are welcome to join us Saturday, March 20, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. via Zoom. If you can RSVP by March 16, a Tuesday, that would be great. Contact Maricela Smith. Maricela is at 916-733-0258 or go to msmith@scd.org. Also, the Diocese of Sacramento is putting together Worship the Lord in the Beauty of Holiness, a five-part series. The first part that will begin March 19 to 20. It's a five-part series for liturgy committee members, liturgy coordinators, liturgical ministers, musicians, as well as teachers, catechists, and those who do sacramental preparation to promote the fully conscious and active participation of all the faithful by forming qualified liturgical leaders to achieve beautiful and dignified liturgies according to the teachings of the Church, drawing upon sacred scripture and primary liturgical documents. This series offers a comprehensive introduction to liturgical principles and practices through selected readings, lecture, discussion, and individual projects. Practical application will be emphasized. It's just $15 a person, $50 if you sign up for all five sessions. And they're once a month, beginning March 19 to 20, Fridays 7 to 8:30 p.m., and Saturdays 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. via Zoom. For more information, contact Laura Lynn Solano. She's at 916-733-0153, or give her an email at L. Solano, just like the county, S-O-L-A-N-O, L. Solano, at scd.org. Again, 916-733-0153. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town, and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.